Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:08 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 3rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I have a bit of a cold, so if I sneeze somewhere along the way, I do apologize. When we look at the Dow Gold ratio, there has been some consistency over the course of the last century. Each major high at least is higher than the last. There is approximately 35-36 years between the peaks, and we also have got these persistent moves where there has been support found in the region of the 1,000-day moving average or the 200-week moving average on successive occasions during the advances of equities versus gold. Now the ratio has most recently bounced from that long-term moving average in the course of just the last few months, and that represented a significant medium-term peak for gold prices, but we now are seeing the price of gold back at those peaks. So I think it is appropriate at this point to ask the question, are we going to see this pattern of gold outperforming equities persist and a substantial move back below the trend mean, which would greatly, I think, question the sustainability of the secular bull market of equities versus gold? Or are we going to see equities pop on the upside from here and continue to run and outperform gold over the course of the next few years? It's a big question, and it's something that we're going to probably find an answer to at some point in the first 6 months of 2020. This is a very important area for equities and for gold. I think it's a good talking point to look at right now, because we have two very clear competing arguments. If, for example, we look at the Dow Jones on a 10-year basis, then it has been trending higher in a really quite persistent manner. There have been three major periods of underperformance. They generally lasted about 18 months, and then we had a resolution of that volatile ranging phase with a break on the upside, which has been really quite persistent, and we are seeing another one of those breakouts right now. Therefore, this is a rather interesting condition right now to be talking about. Are equities going to outperform gold? Because there's nothing on that chart says that this isn't going to remain the case. It's a rather easy chart now to analyze. If we then just insert an additional moving average, or really I think just switch this out to 200 weeks, we get, I think, additional information. There have been three major pullbacks in a decade-long uptrend. Each of them has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average. Each one of the breakouts from these ranging phases has been sustained. So, on the very minimum, the absolute minimum requirement to question the integrity of the decade-long advance would be for the breakout to fail. That would, therefore, start to test the region of the 200-day moving average. Even then, that would be a trend inconsistency. It would certainly be a failed upside break. A failed upside break tells us that there is ample supply above the market, and that at least temporarily demand has been satiated. We haven't yet seen that. Even despite the fact that we have a short-term overbought condition, it would still have to pull back by in excess of 1,500 points to signal a failed upside break. And even then, it would still be above the 200-day moving average. We would need to see a sustained move below the 1,000-day moving average. That's 5,000 points below where the index is trading at present. And that would be a rather profound pullback, and yet it would still only then question the consistency of the overall advance. But it would represent a major inconsistency because of the failed upside break. If we get a failed upside break, there's a strong likelihood we'd come back down and test the lower side of the range. The lower side of the range right now pretty much approximates the region of that 1,000-day moving average. So I think that's probably the worst-case scenario. But we just don't have any evidence of that right now. Now, obviously, we've had an uptick in the geopolitical tensions, and this is something that is probably going to be a factor in terms of investing for the foreseeable future. And we'll sort of speak more about that in probably the latter half of this broadcast. So when we look at the Dow Jones, we're still presented with a consistent trend. The consistency of the long-term trend has become more obvious over the course of the last year. And with these ranges one above another, and with the tendency to find support in the region of 1,000-day moving average and the ability to sustain breakouts, that this is a very clear and consistent trend. And we would need to see a very clear break in that pattern of consistency to question the secular bull market hypothesis. That's what the trend is telling us. That's what people are literally doing with their money. That doesn't mean that there aren't things to worry about, but one thing we do know is that we are still in a highly liquidity-fueled market environment. And that's part of the reason why gold continues to outperform. Now, when we apply the same logic to gold prices, they did almost nothing at all between 2013 and at the first quarter of this year. We have this clear rounding characteristic, and we've just had a base formation completion. Now, one thing that we have ample evidence of over many examples and years of looking at charts is that the bigger the base, the bigger the breakout. And we have been going sideways for 6.5 years. We've had the substantial breakout, and now the price is back testing the region of the peak from back in September. $1,550 was the peak in September. We're at $1,549 today. And when we look at this longer-term chart and the ability that we've seen of gold to rally, when it breaks out of ranges, just historically, it is quite capable of rallying by $200. And we've seen plenty of evidence of that over the course of the bull market in the early to, or, well, from 2000 all the way through to 2011. Well, when it broke out in June of this year, it tacked on approximately $150. And the most important point is that I've seen a number of people talking about $1,700 being a target for this year. That isn't quite 10% from where the price is right now. And I think that that is also a very good example of the modest way that people come up with targets following long periods of underperformance. Because what they do is they go back and they look at what has the market done over the course of the last few years. Then they say, well, it's probably going to repeat that. But that is to underestimate the power that is built up within a base formation. This first step above the base that's been forming for the last 3 months hasn't quite yet been completed, but it does look like we're going to see additional upside from here. But of course, the important point here is that gold has got the base underneath it. It has got the potential for a bull market in front of it. Wall Street has been rallying for 10 years already. It It does not look like it's over. But it's got a lot more work to do to maintain its position of outperformance over the coming years than gold does. But they're both rallying for much the same reason. I would also like to highlight that there is a clear historical commonality that we have in the gold price, because the initial pull, break of the downtrend occurred in late 2015 through to the first quarter of, or the first half of 2016. And then we had an almost 3-year hiatus. When we go all the way back and look at the period following the big pop on the upside in 1999, it came all the way back down and tested the lows, and it wasn't really until about 2 years later that we saw the breakout. Well, it was 3.5 years. That is really very similar to the kind of condition that we've had quite recently. And I do think that there are historical comparisons here, because following the bust of the TMT bubble in the late 1990s, and then the monetary response to 9/11, the market was flooded with liquidity, and interest rates were brought down to what were then historically low levels and held there for a prolonged period of time. And that created this anxiety about the purchasing power of fiat currencies. And we are seeing exactly the same thing happen today. The monetary response that we've had from the illiquidity in the repo market in September has been incredibly acute, and $400 billion in additional liquidity poured into the market has had a really quite considerable impact on investor sentiment. It has been one of the causal factors in the outperformance of stocks over the course of the last 4 months. It has been a causal factor in the interest in gold because of the real potential that we're going to see a clear and concerted effort to devalue the purchasing power of currencies. The USA is currently running trillion-dollar deficits and printing dollars like they're going out of fashion. What it is also creating is the potential for clear moral hazard. When we think about the impact that this provision of liquidity has had, it's not simply that we've had the significant pop on the upside for asset prices, but it has also resulted in a very significant compression of risk measures in the fixed income markets. When we look at the very clear compression in high yield spreads put in the last couple of weeks of December, high yield spreads are back down to the narrows put in 2017 and 2018. There was a clear sense that we were seeing some pressure building in the high yield market at the beginning of last year, and that has now been completely unwound by the balance sheet measures deployed by the Federal Reserve. When we look at the credit default swap spread for investment grade debt, it is also, in fact, it was at a new all-time low just last week. Now, we've had a little bit of easing in terms of that compression in here today, but this has been a phenomenal compression in the attitude towards risk. If you go back and remember what was going on at the end of last year, people were really starting to talk about fallen angel risk and the potential that we were going to see some significant downgrades from the bloated triple B sector into double Bs. That would greatly increase the quantity of debt with high yield or with a junk status, and that would represent an upward pressure on spreads. Well, all of that risk has now been priced out of the market. Now, that does not necessarily mean that the kinds of companies that have got weak balance sheets or have got zombie credentials in terms of their ability to continue to fund operations without extraordinarily low interest rates. In fact, I think it would be it's quite clear that nothing has changed in terms of those particular arguments. But the big change has been in the provision of liquidity. The big question we had at the beginning of 2019 was, where was the liquidity going to come from to continue to animate investor interest in asset prices? The Federal Reserve at the time was contracting their balance sheet, raising interest rates. The ECB had ended their quantitative easing program, and Japan was not looking particularly enthusiastic about persisting in its quantitative easing. China was not stimulating its economy. In fact, they were trying to combat their problem with the shadow banking sector. And investors were starting to sound the alarm that there was real chance of a recession if we weren't going to see additional sources of new liquidity hitting the market. And central bankers listened, and the Federal Reserve has now cut rates 3 times. I think it's unlikely they're going to cut rates again in 2020, particularly ahead of the US presidential election. The ECB is back engaged in quantitative easing. Japan may have raised their sales tax, but they're still engaged in quantitative easing. And China has cut the reserve requirements on their banks, I believe it's 4 times now in the last year. Every time they do that, it sends additional liquidity into the market. Now, what they're additionally starting to do is opening up their financial sector. Now, there is obviously some risk in that, in potentially that foreign banks are going to be coming into the market when bad loans are starting to arise and become a significant issue for China. But that infusion of additional capital is something that could delay the problem for a while longer. All of this additional liquidity is helping to stoke investor appetite for stocks, for bonds, and for gold. But something has to give up if everything else is rallying. And the dollar index has pulled back over the course of the last few weeks. And it didn't quite hold its rebound in here today. If the Federal Reserve is massively increasing the supply of dollars, and the interest rate differential has contracted, although is still in the dollar's favor, then it is simply a question of supply and demand. One of the reasons why the dollar has been so firm over the course of the last few years has been because of a dearth of dollars. Now the supply of dollars is increasing, and that should represent a contraction in this. That's the wrong way to think about it. The supply of dollars is increasing, then therefore that should represent a bonus for just about everything that relies on dollars for funding. That's particularly true of the emerging markets. When we think about the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF, then it underperformed for a good part of 2018, but it moved to a new recovery high in here this week. It's been largely range-bound for nearly 12 years. A good part of the reason why it underperformed for the last couple of years was because its largest constituent is Tencent. But Tencent has found support in the region of the lows put in 2019, and it's coming back up towards the peak put in at the beginning of 2019. This looks like a period of consolidation, and perhaps the worst is behind the share. The Chinese market broke on the upside in here this week, so it is now back above its trend mean, having spent the last 7 or 8 months doing pretty much nothing. Now, we can look at the A-share market over the course of the last 20 years and conclude that it is enormously prone to speculative manias. In between, we tend to get volatile ranging. And right now, we're coming from the lower side of the range, potentially back up towards the upper side. When we look at what the potential range of outcomes is, we're potentially now entering a very clearly liquidity-fueled environment. The cyclically adjusted PEs that people have been worrying about now for probably 3 years continue to expand. We're not at a position where valuations are especially attractive for the USA, but the trends remain very much intact. The NASDAQ, for example, has been leading on the upside, and it is somewhat overbought in the short term. But really, a sustained move below 8,000 would be the minimum required to question the consistency of the overall advance. And technological innovation is a very significant factor. The largest constituents of the index represent the greatest percentage of the index that we've seen since at least the tech boom in the late 1990s. The unifying characteristic between the FANG shares like Facebook or Apple or Amazon or Google or indeed Microsoft is that they have developed large cloud-based businesses. I think it is also worth highlighting that Amazon has pushed successfully above the $1,800 level in the last 10 days. And that is a very meaningful move. It had been ranging below its 40-week moving average for most of the last few months. There was a very clear question about whether it was going to be able to sustain a move back above it. But it has now done that, and it found support in the region of that 200-day moving average this week. This is rather important. Amazon has been one of the go-to shares for investors over the course of the last decade because of its spectacular outperformance. And the fact that it has now been able to push back above the trend mean is supportive of the view that it is still in a bull market environment. The evolution of the cloud business and the use of the data that is acquired by these companies has represented a massive source of productivity growth for those companies. It has opened up entirely new markets. It's enabled them to utilize the data that they have been able to access from users to create whole ranges of new products and ways of generating income that were simply not possible a decade ago. The rolling out of smart speakers, which are effectively being subsidized by companies like Apple and or Amazon and Google, is a further iteration of that trend. The rollout of 5G in 2020, which will pretty much be ubiquitous by the end of this year, is an additional iteration of that trend. It will greatly increase the quantity of data that companies can acquire from users. It will also greatly increase the access to information that users will be able to have access to. So this is there is a certain quid pro quo. I got a notice today from Google asking me to look at my privacy settings because of the new laws that have come into play in California on January 1st. Going through that, you get a clear indication of just how much information they are privy to. But what it also makes very clear is the range of services that are available as a result of the data that they are privy to. So there is certainly a quid pro quo. I don't really see that the majority of consumers are going to have a problem with the kind of data that is being gathered by them. And certainly that is true of the continued use of social media platforms. I certainly see that my daughter is spending a lot more time on Instagram in the last 6 months than she ever did in the 6 months previous. And Facebook has cleared the $200 level, and there is the clear potential that it is going to be able to resolve this 18-month range with a break on the upside. What we are potentially now entering is a more aggressive phase of advance. And there is the clear potential that we are entering a bubble phase. The massive provision of liquidity and the potential for inflationary pressures to start to rise have to, I think, be considered. What we also have to bear in mind is that we're at an interesting stage, because generally, when you look at the share of loss-making small caps versus investment-grade spreads, you tend to get a reasonable correlation. Well, the number of loss-making shares is approaching all-time highs, and yet investment-grade spreads are approaching their lows. Now, this is something that is rather or is not something we've seen previously, I think is probably the best way to say that. Now, that is a testament to the extraordinary monetary policy that we have seen over the course of the last decade. And this does have disruption written all over it. The fact that we've seen a very clear and different trend in terms of the kinds of relationships that were quite reliable over history and have become less so recently, that tells us that we've had a distortion in terms of the interaction between various asset classes because of the massive infusions of liquidity. The fact that corporate profits have been going sideways, but EPS growth has been surging higher over the course of the last 4 years, is a testament to the buybacks, which has boosted EPS growth, but it's also reflective of the potential, or it's not certainly not potential, but the tendency of the very large companies to continue to be able to generate outsized profits, and their rather large weighting relative to the wider market. But it is also worth considering that the equal weight S&P 500 has also been rather steady. So it isn't simply that it is the larger companies have been pushing on the upside, but rather that all companies have been dragged higher by this really quite impressive advance, and the equal weight index is also pushing on the upside. It's not quite as overextended as the wider market. Now, when we then think about the smaller caps, they have also been able to break on the upside. There is, I think, the potential that we're moving into the bubbly phase. These relationships that are heavily dependent on the supply of liquidity are they do suggest that we're late in the cycle. Now, when we think about that relative to the current outperformance of gold, That does tell us as well that investors are starting to hedge their bets, that they're willing to believe that that deficits are not sustainable indefinitely, and that the best time to be invested is during the bubble phase, but one does have to start to think about an exit strategy. That's part of the reason why gold is doing better. But one of the, I think, additional points is that we do have an increasingly large number of things to worry about. Oil prices were up at $2.38 today. Now, that does have to be put in the context of the wider market and the fact that it has been going sideways for the last couple of years. There has still been a downward bias, but the price is now back approximating the spike high following the drone attack on the Saudi Arabian refinery back in October. This is a pattern of attacks on key pieces of infrastructure. There have been attacks on pipelines, there have been attacks on refineries. Well, now we've had an assassination of a key military figure in Iran, or from Iran, but in Iraq. That obviously is an escalation of tensions between the USA and Iran. It is tantamount to a declaration of war when you start taking out generals. So there is the real potential that this is going to escalate. It does suggest that Iran is going to start targeting tankers. But it is worth remembering that the USA is now an energy exporter, that it became energy independent in 2019. And one of the reasons why Soleimani hasn't been assassinated previously, that option was on the table for both President George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and neither of them took it. They were worried about the impact that it would have on oil prices, the economy, and the potential for an outright war with Iran. The reality is that President Trump has got more options on the table because the USA is now a net energy exporter. That does mean that they have greater leeway. They can be a the USA can be a supplier at the margin for the global economy. And that rebalances the geopolitical equation. It does suggest that we're going to have a more aggressive and more volatile geopolitical environment because there isn't quite the same need to retain the stability of the oil price. In fact, the USA probably doesn't need a very high oil price, but certainly a somewhat higher oil price wouldn't go amiss. That's particularly true for the shale producers. When we look at the West Texas Intermediate price, it's still trading at a $5 discount to Brent crude. There is a great deal of additional oil in the USA becomes economic around the $80 area. When we look at the futures curve, we still have a very wide backwardation. And if we are, well, let's just put ourselves in the position of a shale producer that needs, well, say, $100 million to ensure that they have the capital necessary to deploy horizontal wells at depth for the next few years. Well, if they need to do that out for the next 2 to 3 years, they're probably not going to be able to get more than $52 to $50 for their futures when they're trying to sell that future oil. And that's just not really attractive. On the other hand, if we were either to see this at the belly in the curve start to come back up towards $60, or we were to see prices move meaningfully higher, well, then that would greatly increase the economics of future selling for a number of those shale producers. And I rather think that that is what we're probably going to see. And what it does mean is we're probably going to see prices move back towards the $80 area before they'll start hedging aggressively once more. It's also worth considering that the private equity sector has got more dry powder today than ever before, and it's running into trillions of dollars. One of the clearest arguments that people are making is that the energy sector represents value. But it only represents value if one has got a long-term yield perspective. The S&P 500 energy sector has been ranging above 400 for most of the last decade. It's at the lower side of that range right now, but it wasn't quite able to hold the advance that we had in here today. And it has the potential that it could well hold the 450 area, but it's going to have to do that in the next couple of weeks in order to clearly suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The bigger picture, however, is that oil is more likely to range than trend, and it's going to require a very significant change in the geopolitical environment, and probably an outright war with Iran to really change that calculation. We would have to see supply out of the Persian Gulf completely stopped in order to really suggest that we're going to see prices move significantly above $80 and stay there. Of course, that would be a causal factor in compressing the better way of saying it would be exaggerating the risk of a recession because of the tax that oil continues to represent on consumption. There is an additional way of thinking about it, and it is that Tesla has more than doubled in the last 6 months, and it is now above $400 for the first time, and it's looking very overbought in the short term. And this is not the first time it has become very overbought. Generally speaking, it is big downward dynamics signal peaks of medium-term significance for the share. But the broader picture is that they're producing electric vehicles, and electric vehicles don't need oil. And one of the most successful things they've done has been to create a vehicle that people actually aspire to own. And they're doing so at a cost that is competitive with the Toyota Prius or the BMW 3 Series. The sticker price is generally what people tend to look at, but what the vast majority of consumers look at is the lease value. And the monthly lease on a Tesla is approximately, a Tesla Model 3 is about $380. For a Toyota Prius, it's about $350. And for a BMW 3 Series, it's probably more like $410. Well, Tesla is a more attractive vehicle than a Prius, and it goes faster than a BMW 3 Series. There is obviously a clear incentive for investors to be enthused about the potential for Tesla to become a major automotive company, but it's even more enthusiastic from the perspective of a consumer, where they get to stop buying gasoline. So that does suggest that there is potential here for the oil price and the deteriorating geopolitical environment to create a tailwind for the electrification of the automotive sector. What we are also starting to see is that the broader automotive sector is starting to pick up. Ford is right in the region of its trend mean, So is GM. They haven't quite been able to break on the upside. Volkswagen may be on the cusp of settling some of its exposure to the diesel cheating scandal, but one thing that we can say clearly is that none of these company or these share prices are really grabbing the attention of investors. Whereas another electric car producer, NIO, from China, has broken back above its trend mean after a rather lengthy period of underperformance. When we then think about BYD, it's been around for longer, so there is the clear potential for it to also benefit, but it is going to have to do better than it has already been doing. What all of these charts tell us is that the automotive sector is heavily geared towards the health of the global consumer, and the growth fears that were part of the lexicon for all of 2019 may be starting to ease, and not least because of the potential for the trade war between the USA and China to continue to move into hiatus stage. We have the US presidential election coming up in November of this year. We have got the real potential that we're moving into a period of modern monetary theory where there is clear and sustained cooperation between the monetary and fiscal authorities, that the Federal Reserve will continue to monetize the debt produced by the Treasury, and that is likely to have a deleterious effect on the dollar. The fact that the European stock markets are now breaking on the upside and have pushed through the 400-point level suggests that Europe has got the scope to be one of the clearest beneficiaries of the hiatus in global trade. The Nikkei is probably going to or I think experience some of a headwind in the region of the 23 to 24,000 level at the upper side of its range, not least because of the potential for the yen to continue to strengthen. And it has the yen has now broken the dollar sequence of higher reaction lows against it. The renminbi is also strengthening here and is now coming back to test the region of the trend mean. China definitely doesn't want to have a stronger currency, but the bigger question is it willing to run the kinds of stimulative measures necessary to weaken the currency against the onslaught of supply that's coming out of the USA? Then, when we think about the pound, it rallied really very spectacularly in the last quarter of last year. We continue to see now some consolidation of that move. I do think the pound is going to be more volatile over the course of 2020 because of the brinksmanship we can expect with regard to the negotiation of the UK's position relative to the EU over the foreseeable future. But the much bigger point is that if the dollar is in fact peaking, that should help to create demand for European assets. What I think is particularly interesting is that while the vast majority of people are looking at developed Europe, it is Eastern Europe has been leading on the upside. And these markets like Vilnius or Hungary have been doing surprisingly well over the course of the last few years. The Polish market is rallying from the lower side of its range, and the Czech market is just on the process of breaking up and out of a ranging phase that's been going on now for most of the decade. some of the best performing oil companies in the world are in Russia. The stock market index there has also been doing better and is continuing to trend higher. The Brazilian market also has the potential to continue to do better, but it is looking increasingly overextended right now, particularly following the very impressive move up to the peak that we're seeing right now. But it's also worth remembering that the time when Brazil did best was when the real was strengthening, and that was all the way through from 2002 to 2008. It's right in the region of its trend mean right now. This has been a particular period of strengthening, and Brazil is a country that should do better if oil prices do improve from here, not least because it's a higher cost producer. The Canadian dollar was or has now broken to new recovery highs and trading stronger than 130. So that is also a major commodity producer. The continuous commodity index has continued to push up and continues to extend its rebound, having broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It's still in an overall ranging phase over the last 4 years, but it does look like we're seeing a further continuation of the range at the minimum, potentially that it can do better than that. And this is, of course, tied to the scope for global reflation. Of course, the reflationary trade is tied both to the hiatus in terms of the trade war between the USA and China, and the only thing I think that would really pierce the enthusiasm about that outcome is a surge in oil prices. That does represent a major wild card in terms of the sustainability of the uptrends on Wall Street and the breakouts that we've seen in both developed markets internationally and in emerging markets. For countries that are major importers like Japan or India, then a surge in oil prices would represent a particular challenge. But we're not quite there yet. And the fact that the USA is now a major exporter of oil is also a very significant factor. The most important thing will be to monitor the consistency of trends. It does look like we're seeing both gold breaking on the upside and Wall Street continuing to surge. The prime consistency of these breakouts from lengthy ranges on Wall Street is that they've all been sustained. As long as the breakouts are being sustained, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But I think the clearest change in trends that we've seen recently has been the strength in the dollar is giving way to a pattern of weakness, and that is one of the primary reasons why commodities are doing better and emerging markets are doing better. It's almost a rehash of what we saw in the period from 2000 on to 2010, and the fears about the reduced purchasing power of fiat currencies are almost the same today as they were then as well. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.